God's Economy, Law, Politics, and Economics in Ancient Israel was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 10, 2009 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that the presenter's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
All right, we're going to talk about the Old Testament law. The focus of my remarks are going to be basically around the issue of to what extent does the Old Testament law apply to us today, or for that matter, to what extent does the Old Testament law have any application to the way a people group, whoever they are, some Gentile people group out there, organize themselves politically, governmentally, as a society and as an economy. Is there something about the fact that this is in the Bible that obligates us to make that the standard and the measure of how we do government in a society? As you may know, there is a movement or a group of people, largely from the Reform tradition, called Theonomists, who believe that not only is it prophesied and predicted that that will be the case, but that it's the morally right thing to do to go back to the Mosaic law and make that the law of, in our case, America. So we would want to institute the commandments and requirements of the Mosaic covenant here in our land. So that's in the background of my remarks as we go through here. I think the crucial thing in understanding the Old Testament law, the Mosaic Covenant, I will use those interchangeably, Mosaic Covenant or Old Testament law. I mean the same thing by either of those. If we're going to understand it, we have to understand the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant. And I hope it became clear in the reading that you did. It was not clear at all to me for years, and it was when I went back and really seriously read Deuteronomy for the first time that this just jumped out at me. That to understand the Mosaic Covenant, you have to go all the way back to Abraham. That's the context in which God himself says he's making the covenant with Israel. He's keeping a promise that he made to Abraham several generations earlier. So the Mosaic Covenant is basically simply God making good on part of the Abrahamic Covenant. They are not different covenants. They are not distinct. It's not a new thing. It's God keeping the promise that he made to Abraham. What was that promise? He made several streams to that promise, but the one that's relevant to the Mosaic Covenant is he promised that he would make him a father of a great nation. He would multiply his seed as the stars of the heaven and the sands of the sea. And he would come and enter into a relationship with that seed, with those descendants, that people group. He would be their God, and they would be his people. Well, notice how much that language gets repeated in Deuteronomy. I will be your God, and you will be my people. What is the Mosaic Covenant? The Mosaic Covenant is God coming along and defining what the terms of that relationship are. What is it going to look like for me to be your God? Well, I will take you into the land, and I will prosper you there, and I will protect you from your enemies. I will give you rest in the land, and you will have this impact on the nations around you. I'm going to bring all this stuff to pass. I'm promising that if you will keep the covenant, all these things will come to pass. That's what it's going to look like for me acting as your God. And what will it look like if you act like you are my people? Well, you will do these things. You will implement these rituals, these practices, these ways of socially organizing yourself and so on. And as becomes apparent rather quickly, and you're going to look a little odd in the world if you follow these requirements because not everyone does it that way. So you're going to kind of stand out as those people are different, and they're different because they are the people of God. They are the people who have a unique relationship and a unique covenant and a unique set of promises that they've received from God. So I think first and foremost, in understanding the Old Testament law of the Mosaic Covenant, we have to understand that that's what's going on. Given that that's what's going on, what is it not? It is not God coming into history and saying to the Jews, let me tell you how any people group should organize themselves if they're going to have a just and fair and righteous and equitable society. Everybody should do this, but I'm just going to call you to do this so that you can show the rest of the people how to do it. That's not what's going on. And I think I just grew up in Christian culture just assuming that that would be the right way to think about it. And that's where theonomy then gets its intuitive kind of attraction, is we all believe that anyway, at some level, is that, of course, why wouldn't you want to implement the Mosaic Law, the law of God, after all? Why wouldn't you want to implement that? It's in the Bible. But we have ripped it out of its historical context when we think that way. Because this is not just the way everybody should conduct themselves. This is the way that unique people who have a unique relationship with the Creator, that God is doing this unique and special thing in history among this people of his own choosing, the Jews. And he's calling them to a unique relationship with all kinds of peculiar traits to it. Okay, that's the first point that I think we have to keep in mind. The second thing we have to keep in mind is that the Mosaic Covenant is not a covenant between an individual Jew and his God. It's a covenant between the entire nation, the entire people, and their God. It's a group project that can only be kept and fulfilled as a group. An isolated individual cannot keep the Mosaic Covenant. To illustrate that, for example, I don't know if these were in our readings, but somewhere in Deuteronomy, you have these laws. If your neighbor blasphemes, you need to stone him to death. If you fail to stone your neighbor to death for his blasphemy, your neighbor needs to stone you to death. Well, how does an individual keep that law? You have to have the cooperation of everyone in the culture, in the society, being on board with taking this covenant seriously and organizing itself in a particular way and dealing out the punishments that the covenant says that you need to deal out. You have cities of refuge, you have the Sabbath debt-forgiving things, the Day of Jubilee, or the Year of Jubilee, you have the festivals, all of which are socially fulfilled. It's the entire people needs to come together and do this thing together. So if you're just an isolated individual, the only one in the nation that loves God, you can't keep the covenant. There's no way you can keep the covenant. You can respect it, and you can keep some of the requirements of the covenant, but to really fulfill the obligation that you as Israel have with your God, an individual cannot do that. So that's the second thing that you have to keep in mind. Third thing you have to keep in mind is that I think the specific requirements and the specific commandments that you find in the Mosaic Covenant are of two distinctly different kinds. On the one hand, you have, notice that God is coming and establishing this relationship. I will be your God and you will be my people. Well, who is this who's going to be their God? This is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is the true God, the actual author of all reality, the transcendent creator who really is there. And who is this God, this transcendent creator God who really is there? He is a good and righteous God. Pure God, morally pure. So it only stands to reason that part of what this God is going to require of his people, if they are going to be his people, is that they would reflect, imitate, follow, emulate the goodness of the God that is their God. So you find intertwined throughout all of the requirements in the Mosaic Covenant a certain vision of what it looks like to be a good and righteous human being. So you have requirements against murder, against theft, against adultery, against cheating people, against lying and deceiving. All of that is intertwined through everything in the covenant. We were struck in our group by how much compassion is called upon for the people of Israel. Compassion, sensitivity, don't be unjust. It's a very thoroughly moral set of requirements. not that everything is in it is a moral requirement, but interlaced throughout everything is a very, very important moral vision. So some of the commandments themselves are simply strictly a matter of being good and righteous. Other commandments are not about that. We'll talk about what they are and about in a second. But that's one thread throughout all of the covenant, is commanding his people to be good people, to be just people, to be righteous people. So there's a vision for godliness, a vision for what it means to be a good human being that you can certainly abstract from the covenant. But notice that you are abstracting it from the covenant. Gentiles never have been and never will be subject to the Mosaic covenant as a covenant. It's not a covenant made with me. It's not a covenant made with my people group. It has nothing to do with me, on the one hand. But I can look at what God required of his people, and one of the things that I see is he was requiring that they be godly. And that's a requirement on every human being as a human being, is that human beings should be godly. So if I want to know, if I want to be instructed, if I want to be helped to understand this vision of what it means to be a godly human being, the Mosaic Covenant is a good place to go for that kind of information, if I abstract it from the covenant. But that's the crucial thing, is I have to abstract it. I'm not just obeying the covenant. I'm looking at the covenant and using the covenant to get some kind of idea of what this vision is for what it means to be a good person that you see reflected in the covenant. But there's a second theme throughout the Mosaic Covenant that is equally strong, if not even stronger in some respects, that many of the commandments are basically intended to mark off the people of Israel as a unique and a peculiar people in God's divine purposes. That the word that most typically gets used to describe them is they are holy. They're a nation of holy people who have been set apart by God to play a unique and special role and purpose in God's scheme of things. And in order to that they might wear that on the outside, in their clothing, in the way they wear their hair or beards, in the way they eat, in so many different ways, in the way they do religion, all of that was intended to make them distinctive and peculiar and unique as a people, in order that that unique relationship that they have with God would be displayed in a variety of ways. Some of the many, I think, of the ways in which they were to be odd and peculiar had symbolic value. And so, for example, the not mixing two kinds of fabrics together, when you having clothing that mixes two kinds of fabrics together, is it because there's something inherently immoral about that? No, I don't think so. Is there something inherently impractical about that? I don't think so, although, like, I would know. I think it's symbolic. That it's a way of, in the very fabric, literally, in the very fabric of the clothing that you wear, you are symbolically displaying the importance of purity. That you must not corrupt, you must not compromise, you must not adulterate, you must not intermingle, you must keep yourself holy, you must keep yourself pure. That's your calling as the people of God. Many of the dietary regulations are probably symbolic. It may be that the symbolism, the value of the symbol, is actually defined by the covenant. It may be that to some extent it pre-exists before the covenant. I don't think we have any way of knowing that. I do suspect that we have lost some of the value of some of the symbolism because we're so far removed culturally and historically, and that if we were closer to the time, or if we were back there in the time, many of the requirements would have some symbolic significance that we just don't get. So that includes, for example, the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day, I think, is a symbol of the hope of the people of God. And they were to practice it in order to weekly reaffirm this hope that they have as a people. That gets confusing to a lot of people because it's in the Ten Commandments, right? The Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath, is in the Ten Commandments. But we have to remember the Ten Commandments is the core of the Mosaic covenant, not the core of godliness and righteousness. That's the importance of my first point. The Mosaic covenant is not God coming to mankind and telling us, here's what godliness is.
it's God coming to his people, the Jews, and saying, I'm going to make a contract with you. I'm going to do this and be your God in that way, and you're going to do this and be my people in that way. It's conditioned by the historical reality of what God is doing in them, in history, at a particular time and place. So the fact that the Sabbath is right at the core of that is not surprising at all. But it still is in the second category of commandments, not the first one. It's not because every godly, righteous individual worth his salt will just one day wake up and go, I can't work, it's Saturday. It's because it's one of these symbolic things that is unique to the people of God to mark them off as a distinctive and holy people. I think the dietary regulations are in that category. Circumcision is in that category. All the festival celebrations that you see prescribed are in that category. The whole sacrificial system, all the liturgy in the temple is in that category. So by the time you sort that out, the preponderance of the requirements are not about righteousness, they're not about godliness, they're about being Jewish in the distinctive and unique kind of way. Still in that category, although not exactly symbolic, I would say, some are simply practical structures that define Israel's social relationships as a uniquely holy people. The Day of Jubilee, I think, arguably is in that category. That's very relevant to our purposes to the extent that we're talking about economics. It would be easy to look at the Mosaic Covenant and say, well, I want to find out what God says about economics. And what God says about economics is every 50 years you should forgive all the debts. Or every 7 years you should forget all the debts, and every 50 years you should give everybody their deed back or something like that. Maybe that might be right, but at least we have to contend with the possibility that something like the Year of Jubilee is a part of what makes the people of Israel a peculiar and unique people. God was doing an unusual thing with them, and as this unusual thing that he was doing with them, he had them relate to one another in an unusual way. Notice they charge interest on loans to non-Jews, but they're not allowed to charge interest on loans to one another. Well, is that because, I mean, which is it? Is it morally permissible to charge interest, or is it morally impermissible to charge interest? They do both, depending upon whether it's their own people or outsiders. Well, it's probably not about morality at all. It's probably morally permissible to charge interest, but not to your own people, the Jews. Why? Because we're doing this unique experiment in human history where we are going to be distinctive as the people of God. So it's not a matter of justice and morality that's at stake there. It's a matter of being peculiar and different and holy as the people of God, set apart as the people of God. Arguably, the Year of Jubilee is in that same category. I think all of the penalties that you have for violating the covenant are a part of that practical structure of social relationships that God is calling upon them, that are there not because it's good and right and just, but because it's a unique thing that he's doing in this people. Let me try to be clearer. They are called at one point a kingdom of priests. He wants to make them a kingdom of priests. They are to be a people who, down to every last man, woman, and child, is holy, a whole people group that has their whole life defined by their holiness before God. Well, holiness does not mean goodness, does not mean righteousness. It means they're having been set apart for a unique and special role in a special and distinctive purpose. Well, as such, one of the things that God is calling them to is a degree of moral purity that is unprecedented. And it's a degree of moral purity as a people group, fundamentally, because this covenant is with a people group, not with individuals. So, why, when someone blasphemes, do you stone them to death? Because that's the right and just penalty for blasphemy? No, I don't think so. It's because this people group is called to be pure in their commitment to the covenant with God and in their taking the covenant God seriously. If they're not going to take the covenant God seriously, they need to be purged from the people group. That is, they need to be dead. They need to be killed. So adultery stone him to death. Blasphemy, stone him to death. Homosexuality, stone him to death. There are a lot of stoning going on if you keep this covenant in the way that he suggested. Or actually, as somebody pointed out in our group, actually, if people were to take on the project of the covenant, there wouldn't be a whole lot of stoning going on. Because there wouldn't be a lot of adultery, there wouldn't be a lot of blasphemy, there wouldn't be homosexuality, there wouldn't be the things that require these penalties. But what's the purpose of the penalty? To enact justice? No. To keep the people group the holy people of God, to keep them pure. Well, if that's the case, if I'm right about that, it would be wrong for us to implement the Mosaic Covenant in America. We shouldn't be stoning blasphemers. We shouldn't be stoning adulterers. We shouldn't be stoning homosexuals. That would be wrong. It would be downright unchristian of us. I mean, it would even be indecent because it's inhumane. We were never promised that we would be the unique people of God, a holy people. We were never promised that God would come and circumcise our hearts and plant in our hearts a heart of flesh in the place of a heart of stone. We were never promised that we would be given the wherewithal to rise to the level of being that kind of holy people. We're sinners. We're Gentile dogs. We're foolish, ignorant Gentiles living in darkness. Of course we are not going to live according to the moral vision that people of Israel are called to. So to penalize us in the same way that the Mosaic Covenant asks them to penalize one another for not being holy in that way doesn't make any sense, I would submit. So anyway, there's two kinds of covenant commandments in the Mosaic Covenant. Moral commandments that are simply grounded in a vision of what it means to be a good and moral person. And then commandments that are grounded in the unique purpose of the covenant to define the people of God as uniquely related to God. And that comes either in symbolic acts that they are to perform regularly and the way they practically organize their society in relationship to one another, economics and otherwise. Another point that we need to keep in mind is that keeping the Mosaic Covenant, and we saw this in our reading, may not be as obvious and explicit as we'd like it to be, but I think if you pay real attention to what Moses is saying, to keep the Mosaic Covenant from God's perspective is not really ultimately a matter of being transgression-free. You don't keep the covenant by not failing to keep all these commandments and statutes. You keep the covenant. It's even embedded in the very meaning of the word keep in English, not to mention Hebrew and Greek as well. To keep something, we have this preserved in a keepsake. What is a keepsake? A keepsake is something that you value so much that you protect it, you guard it. That's what keep means, is to guard, is to protect something. So to keep the commandment is to value this commandment that God, this covenant that God has made with us so much that we learn it, we don't want to forget it, we don't want to neglect it, and we want to strive with all the power within me to do what the commandment says. What does failure mean? It means you're a sinner. It means you're evil. It means you're wicked, just like all the rest of mankind. But the covenant itself had a provision for our sin, for being evil. When you violate and transgress a statute, you take a sin offering, a guilt offering. You take the appropriate offering to the temple to indicate that you're not rejecting the covenant. You're just a sinner, and you have sinned, and you are guilty, and you have violated your relationship with God in a significant way. But you honor the covenant. You are keeping the covenant by taking the appropriate sin offering or guilt offering to the temple and responding appropriately to your violation, your transgression of another commandment. So what God is looking for is a mindset that takes the covenant seriously because it takes the maker of the covenant, the God who made the covenant with Israel, seriously. That's why in one of the last things we read, he says, don't say in your heart, this thing is too difficult for me. It's not too difficult for you. It is in your mouth and it is in your heart, he says. And I think what he's saying is, don't panic. Don't worry if you forget and eat an ossifrage. Don't worry if you run across a dead body in a field and forgot about it. I don't know. That you don't have to remember all the details. You don't have to remember all the specifics. You don't need to be paranoid about your transgression. God is not asking you to be meticulous and perfect and flawless in your performance. He just wants you to take him seriously and therefore take the covenant that he's made seriously. And that's what it would mean to keep the covenant. But Israel did not keep the covenant as was predicted. So here we have in the reading that we did, Moses saying to Israel, you know what? All these commandments and statutes and judgments and ordinances that I'm giving you this day, you're not going to do this stuff. And God's going to come and he's going to curse you in exactly the way he said he was going to curse you. The land is going to vomit you out. You're going to go into captivity for 70 years and so on and so forth. So it predicted that his own people would not keep this covenant. But also in this Deuteronomy passage, it goes on to say, but one day you will keep the covenant. You will return, and I will circumcise your heart, and you will return to the Lord your God, and you will keep the covenant. So the covenant, as such, has the structure of a contract. You do this, and I will do this. You don't do this, and I will do this other thing. Do this, and I will bless you. Don't do this, and I will curse you. It's a bilateral agreement. It's a contract where each party has requirements placed on them. But overriding the contract of the Mosaic Covenant is a larger, more far-reaching, overarching promise. God promised Abraham that in him all the people of the earth would be blessed. God promised Abraham that in him would be a seed, a physical seed descended from him, who would be put in the land, protected from their enemies, prosper and be abundant in the land, and he would give them Shabbat in the land, the Sabbath rest in the land. Well, that overarching promise, Moses is reiterating here in Deuteronomy. Yeah, he made that promise, so you're not going to keep the covenant right away, but the day's going to come where he will restore you to the land, and he will give you a new heart, and in that day you will keep the covenant. So it's going to happen. So my last point is that it's just, and I've already basically made this point, but it's not consistent with the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant to assume that that covenant can define the relationship between any old people group and God. So we as Americans can't claim the Mosaic Covenant for ourselves. God never promised us that we would be a unique people, and God would be our God, and we would be his people, and so on. There's no such promise. So the Mosaic Covenant as such has nothing to do with us. The only relevance it has for us is that it does give us great information, if you can abstract it out of it, for what it means to be a good person. And to that extent, it can be valuable to us. Okay, so when it comes to economics specifically, we have to be very, very careful and use our minds and be very intelligent. The economic relationships that are defined in the Mosaic Covenant, is it because they are just for all people, everywhere, for all time, in every situation, and wise and prudent for all people every time? Or is this something unique to the relationship that God has made with his people Israel? You can't ignore that question. You have to answer that question.
Q&A?
Okay. So are there popular views that do say that it doesn't apply to us today, except for general direction, that there is? Are you asking, are there views like that out there? Or was that a characterization of what I just said? That would be a much more prevalent view, I would think, than the view I just expressed. Everybody in the Reformed tradition would say that. A lot of people outside the Reformed tradition would say that. Just even if it's not a part of a kind of well-articulated and self-conscious theology, I think most Christians pick up from their background that, well, no, duh, the Ten Commandments, you got to do that. And that's why a Seventh-day Adventist comes along and says, well, what about that Sabbath part? And from the logic of where most Christians are, they go, what about that Sabbath part? And they kind of get stuck there because they don't really have the resources to answer that, because they've already conceded that the Mosaic Covenant is really basically for me. Now, you do have dispensationalists who will say, no, the Mosaic Covenant was for a time and place and a people back then, and it really doesn't have any direct relevance to me at all. And some of them then will go so far as to say, I'm not under the commandment to not murder and not commit adultery. it's kind of not consistent with loving your neighbor. But other than that, we shouldn't have any problem with it. You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, well, because let's think about what he's saying there. Is he saying because of the nature of how God created the world, it is righteous to rest on the Sabbath, or it's symbolically meaningful to rest on the Sabbath? And for me, what informs the Sabbath the most is the argument in Hebrews, where he goes to the Psalm, what, 95, Psalm, whatever that is, that he's exegeting there today, and say, do not be as your fathers in the wilderness when they tested the Lord, and he cursed them and said, you shall not enter my rest. And then thinks out loud in Hebrews, well, what rest was he thinking that they wouldn't enter? Because this is like David, it's already after Joshua has given them rest, so it's already been fulfilled in that sense, and he's warning them to not be disobedient as they were, lest they not enter his rest. Well, what rest could he be talking about? Well, and basically I would argue that the rest that he's talking about is the eternal blessing of eternal life itself. And so the way he seems to be understanding the Sabbath is it's a symbolic celebration in anticipation of a reality that all of us hope in, all of us look forward to. Ours is eternal life. Theirs included the promise being kept for rest in the land and stuff as well. But for us as Gentiles, there is a rest that is relevant to us that we look forward one day, when I no longer have to strive against my own unrighteousness and my own sinfulness. It's no longer a struggle. I will be spontaneously good one day. Wow. Well, that's my hope that I am looking forward to. So if I were to keep a Sabbath ritualistically, why would I do it? To symbolize that day, the realization of that hope one day. Well, do we have to symbolize it? Well, no. What's way more important is that we actually have that hope, believe in that hope, want that hope. That's the reality that is important. Nothing wrong with keeping the Sabbath ritualistically in and of itself, but it's not a requirement. It was for them because it was part of their covenant that he made with them. Well, notice I didn't say they were unjust. They're inhumane and indecent, but they're not really unjust. Well, we all deserve to be stoned to death. I mean, there's really nothing unjust about sinners being punished. But in the reality of the history of God playing this out, notice from the first generation of Jews on, they didn't really stone each other to death because they didn't keep the covenant. They just kind of forgot about it and neglected it and ignored it. They didn't keep it. In the end, when he's going to restore them to the land and he will circumcise their hearts and they will know God and they will want to honor him and serve him, at that time there won't be very many, if any, stoned to death because every last man, woman, and child among them will be keeping the covenant. They won't be blasphemers. They won't be adulterers. They won't be murderers. So when all is said and done, in the practical outworking of God making this covenant with his people, it's not really going to work out as having ever been very inhumane, because it's a requirement being placed on a people who he's doing the miracle in their hearts to giving them the existential commitments in their heart that make them up to the task of keeping that covenant. Other than, help me, Earl or David or Ron, but other than a couple of places in Numbers that are right on the heels of this, and even then I'm not sure there's so much fulfilling the letter of the commandment as trying to fulfill the spirit of the commandment, I don't know that any of these penalties were ever implemented. Can you think of any? Yeah, we have one account of that. And Phineas killed
stabbed him. He didn't.
Yeah, he didn't stone him. That's why I say he didn't. Yeah, okay. No.
Well, that doesn't mean there wasn't much.
We just don't know. We don't have a record of it. We don't really know if that account is even supposed to really be in the New Testament, that there's a textual problem there. And I mean, it's the only one in the New Testament that would suggest that could even have been a common occurrence back then. So I just don't know. The woman caught in adultery. But see, notice the context there. I mean, why does he say, assuming it's authentic, why does he say, he who is without sin among you cast the first stone? I think it's because of the context. You have a whole nation that's not keeping the covenant, and you want to selectively apply the commandments here? Why don't we all decide together to keep the covenant, and then we can start talking about this commandment? But you have a whole nation that has forsaken the covenant. So that's what I mean is you can't, as an individual, you can't just decide, okay, I'm going to keep the covenant. No, you got to get the whole nation on board. And that's exactly what's predicted is the whole nation. That's the new covenant in Jeremiah. Every last man, woman, and child will not need to be taught to know the Lord, for they will all know me. Now you have everybody on board wanting to honor God, know God, serve God, obey his covenant. When that day comes, keeping the covenant will be meaningful. But until that day comes, what, selectively decide, I'm going to stone you to death because it's in the law? You know, that doesn't make any sense. Right, I mean, I think they try to define their lives in such a way that they are keeping the covenant as much as you can, as within your purview as an individual. But I think they all recognize in the final analysis, and they don't even have a temple. So until they rebuild the temple, how can they keep the covenant? I mean, I think they're all very cognizant of that. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Let me frame that as a question for David. My assumption about Adam Smith is that Adam Smith is a Scotch Presbyterian who knows good and well what the Bible says about loving your neighbor and that kind of thing. So I think he's just taking it for granted that in, what's the language he uses? In looking out for your, that what he means by self-interest is not acting selfishly. What he means by self-interest in is as you go about making a living for yourself and your family, you are advancing society. Well, what kind of people should be there going about making a living for themselves and their family? Decent Christian folks who love their neighbor, who have compassion on their neighbor, who look out for their neighbor. That's my assumption.
I think that's probably the way he's looking at it. I'm not sure that he was a deist, but he grew up in an environment that was just permeated with Presbyterian assumptions, and those are part of them. If you were to take him and plunge him into another culture, I'm not sure whether he would see his principle as carrying over the way that it should. Because enlightened becomes changed. Long-term may become a little changed.
It was interesting reading Smith for this because I've never really understood his invisible hand before, but somebody said something in our group this morning that it finally kind of triggered for me is I think what his invisible hand is simply the raw logical necessity that if you are looking out for your self-interest, it logically has to be that you're advancing the interest of society as a whole. Now, how does that work? Because how is it that you're looking out for your self-interest? You're seeking to, out of your labor, your energy, your creativity, your imagination, you're seeking to produce something that will enhance life in other people. Now, obviously, there's a value judgment there, and that's why whether you're a Christian or not is going to make a big difference, or whether you have a biblical view of righteousness is going to make a big difference. But assuming you have a good judgment about what would enhance life for other people, you're deciding, I can produce this thing that's going to make other people's lives genuinely, authentically better, and I can make enough of it that I can trade them. Well, what is it that everybody is doing then? They're making products and producing things or producing services that are life-enhancing. And he's just saying, does it not logically follow, inevitably by logic alone, that all of society is going to be benefited by people spending their energy and creativity and imagination creating life-enhancing products and services?
What's interesting about that is it now depends on what society sees as life-enhancing.
Right, right.
So you can have a whole economy developed around the production of pornography, right, if that's what's life-enhancing.
If that's their view.
Mm-hmm. In what we read, he's only prescriptive when he talks about education. And with tariffs, he's raising the question with respect to tariffs. In the first part, he's not being prescriptive at all. But in other parts of the book, he is prescriptive. But he's living in a time and place in which no one is asking the question, no one's really debating the question, what is life all about? Europe is a thoroughly Christian environment in which they're bringing Christian values to the question, what life is all about, and that's not really being debated at that level. There are theological debates happening, of course, but they aren't debates about sort of getting right at the heart of what is a human being and what are we supposed to be doing here on earth with respect to God. Right. That there is some tension between his view of what a human being is and this environment, this economic environment that's coming into being. I think that's definitely true. Right. But he is being descriptive, but I really think that he is in awe of that phenomenon, and he sees the fact that wealth can be produced is striking to him. I don't think that he is critical of wealth being produced. So that's a good thing. It doesn't. I don't think it really occurs to him to think otherwise.
Off the top, I want to say no. I think it all can be fulfilled individually, but that's a good question. I have to think about that. And I made a distinction between requirements that can only be kept as a group socially versus requirements that an individual could keep. And the question was, what about those aspects of the Mosaic Covenant that are moral in nature, that define what it means to be a good human being? Are any of those of such a nature that only a social group can keep them together? And for a variety of reasons, I have a very strong temptation to answer no, they can all be fulfilled as an individual. But I that's a good question. I'd have to think about that. The law requires that you go get stoned with them. Yeah, notice that Jesus was pretty impressed by the very unimpressive gift of the widow who dropped her little widow's mite in the treasury. It didn't really do much of any consequence to the temple in Herod, but Jesus was pretty impressed with her. So one of the points that I will make on Friday in my paper is that we are so accustomed to think consequentially. That is, you judge the moral value of what you do by the consequences of your action. Jesus doesn't seem to think that way. You could be completely upright and righteous of heart and have little effect for the good on the life of another human being, but you did what you could, and the heart that was driving it was a heart of love for your neighbor. So, I mean, what you're saying is certainly true. If we pool our resources and get organized, in terms of consequences, we can have greater consequences. Have we become more obedient? Have we become more righteous? Or even, indeed, have we become more loving that way? I'm going to argue on Friday that I don't think so, that those are different issues. Yeah, the question is, can you truly be righteous without having someone as the benefit of your righteousness? Is that your... Yeah, I think the answer is yes, I do. That I think righteousness is ultimately internal. And it's true that the Bible warns us against not externalizing our righteousness. Don't love in word and tongue, but in deed and in truth. It's important that you externalize it in concrete, practical ways. That's true. But not because that's what made it righteous and it wasn't righteous before. That's what shows that it's authentic, whereas otherwise it could be inauthentic. It's easy to say to someone, I love you, but if you don't back it up with actions, then what was the substance of that so-called inner reality that's there? How do I know you're not just lying? You're not just saying that. When we fill it out with actions, we have demonstrated that it really was a commitment to love inside. But I think it's the internal commitment itself that is the righteousness, I think. I think that's the most reasonable way to read the covenant, is that because it's incredible. And the other thing that struck me is in reading Genesis, it's like reading a surveyor's description of it, the land of the Kenites and the termites and the parasites. This very, very specific land, that's the land I'm giving to you. And so unless in the final analysis there's something about that that was symbolic, and I don't think that's reasonable, then yes, I would expect that that's the land that God is going to put his own people in and protect them there and prosper them there, and they will be his people and he will be their God. And all the promises that he's made to them, he will keep to them in that land then. So, yeah, I think so. We're looking at it rather ethnocentrically, because we're Gentiles with our Gentile questions, and our Gentile questions is, what good is this law for me? Well, Moses doesn't have me in view when he's making that statement. So notice that within the context of Judaism, the distinction between what part of it has a moral grounding and moral base and what part of it has a unique base in the unique covenant that God is making with his people is a relatively unimportant distinction, because they're supposed to keep all of it. You're supposed to do all this stuff. So why does he just throw it all in there together? Because for the people that he's writing to, it all ends up falling in there of equal importance anyway. Now, over the course of their lives and trying to keep the covenant, they're going to be confronted with the important distinction between morality and what's symbolic. And that's why David can say, well, it may be against the law, but it's the loving thing for my men to have them eat the showbread. He can learn to have that depth perception and make that distinction. But he doesn't see himself as disregarding the covenant. He sees himself in a dilemma where he can't do justice to every part of the covenant at the same time, so he has to pick which he thinks is more important. And Jesus applauds him and invites us to do that. Yeah, have some depth perception here. Understand what each one of the requirements, why that might be there and what purpose it might serve and what role it would play in the life of Israel, and then act accordingly. Nothing wrong with having that depth perception. But in terms of just the deliverance of it, these are the terms of the covenant. Do these things and you will live. Don't do these things and you will die. And to his audience, they're all of a piece. Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that. And it may be that further study would vindicate it as not organized in that way, not very rhetorically artful sermon, or whatever you want to call it. And that may be the answer. Yeah, it's not a very rhetorically artful, he's a dying man who's just off the top of his head, stream of consciousness, tell him to remember these things. Maybe that's true. Or further scrutiny may show us that it's more artful than I am aware of. I just haven't studied it well enough to have an answer to that. But neither would bother me if it ends up being rhetorically not very artful. Okay, won't be the first time in human history that important things have not been artful.
I remember reading a commentary one time that referred to these laws as case law. That was helpful to me. That the idea is not that here are a bunch of principles that are being laid out for you, but rather there was this thing that happened, and this was the right judgment with respect to this particular incident. And so it's just listing a bunch of incidents from which our job is to extrapolate then principles that would be more universally applicable.
So is the argument these were actual judgments that got made in the wilderness wanderings that Moses had to
make? Right, that a lot of these are derived from actual cases, and these were the judgments in those cases, and that becomes then the precedent for what ought to be done after that. It could be chronological order.
Well, for the Gentile Christian, I think the only relevance, but it's an important relevance, is that we have to distinguish between those that are there because they embody what it means to be a good and righteous human being. Once we make that determination, then we have a portrait there of what it means to be a good human being. And that's a very important thing. These are instances of what it would look like that we can apply to further instances if we just intelligently apply to ourselves. Well, by analogy, then, what would that mean for this? Like, for example, a good example of that is put a parapet around your house. Doesn't buy us a whole lot of safety in our day and age and our architecture, but back then the roof of the house was a room of the house, and yeah, it was dangerous to not have a fence around it. So in our day and age, a fence around a swimming pool and the various ways that we make sure that people don't inadvertently get harmed by our property and by what we've done. So there's no law about having a fence around a swimming pool to keep your neighbor kids out, but it would be consistent with the spirit of a specific commandment in Deuteronomy. So teaching us the kind of love and compassion and justice and basically love for our neighbor, teaching us to love our neighbor, the law can be very helpful and give us a portrait of what that looks like. For the modern Jew, it remains there, and they're going to have to deal with this. I'll leave it to them to deal with it. But they're going to have to deal with when the Spirit is poured out, as Joel promises it will be, on all the people of Israel, on every last person of Israel. When the Spirit is poured out and they agree together, we have not kept the covenant with the God of our father Abraham, let's do that. Then they're going to have to take on the whole law. And what exactly that will mean, I expect it will be updated. I expect that at that point they will also recognize Jesus as the Messiah. So they may not practice the sin offerings and guilt offerings and stuff, or find another way to keep those commandments or to think about those commandments. But the whole covenant will one day be at some level relevant to them. To a Jewish Christian, we had a conversation with some Messianic Gentiles down in Rogue River. I thought I was a Messianic Gentile, but I found out I wasn't. A Messianic Gentile is a Gentile who doesn't want to be a Jew, but who wants to live like a Messianic Jew. Messianic Jews, they are very much in danger of being this party of the circumcision in Galatians. to the extent that they see obedience to the Mosaic Covenant as what it is all about to be a follower of Jesus, then they're right there with the party of the circumcision that Paul accuses of being a false gospel. So I think they would really have to be careful there. If they want simply to honor their ethnic heritage as Jews to practice many of the practices of that are prescribed by the Mosaic Covenant, I don't think Paul would have any problem with that, as long as they don't expect me as a Gentile to do that with them in order to be a genuine follower of Jesus. But if they're just doing it out of preference, then more power to them. That's fine. Paul did it. Yeah. Did that answer?
I think there is room for considering that. I think there are indications that there is editing that was done not only in the Pentateuch but throughout the Old Testament. My assumption is, though, that that editing was of a limited nature. It isn't wholesale editing like modern scholars often attribute to the creation of the Old Testament. I just have no reason to think otherwise than to take at face value the New Testament's suggestions that the Pentateuch was written by Moses. I think what we have is something that was by and large written by Moses, but was updated according to scribal principles. I think that's important. It's not just they didn't like that word and they threw it out, but they're following certain guidelines that they're being held to that are just updating the text rather than transforming the text. But I think that's highly likely, actually. And I think there are even indications in the text that it's gone through that kind of updating.
Right.
In particular, when he declares Moses the most humble man that ever lived. Yeah. I think Moses was a humble man, and that he recognized, you know, when it comes down to it, the Pentateuch is not about me, and I suspect that the style that he adopted to write it is designed to help convey that it really is not about him. He's just there as a tool that's being used to get that onto papyrus or clay or whatever it was written on.
Well, there's so many things about that. For example, it's just the woman that they're wanting to stone, not the man. Well, if you're really interested in keeping the covenant, then let's keep the covenant. They're both to be stoned to death by the statutes of the commandment. If the whole country was concerned about keeping the covenant, it wouldn't be a question. Yeah, exactly. So there are just so many ways in which it's such a contrived situation, and Jesus is basically calling them on that and going, come on, I'm not going to play your silly little game. When the day comes that we're going to keep the covenant, then we'll keep the covenant. But this is, you're obviously not interested in that right now. So let's look at you. What about you? Aren't you somebody that would be worthy of stoning yourself? And that's way more important to him than this contrived, let's pretend to take the covenant seriously right now. Well, I'm not sure I've got the essence of your question, but ethics is always communal. But ethics is not righteousness. Okay, yeah, because we do absorb from our culture what's expected, what's not expected, what we should do, what we shouldn't do, what we should be shamed by, what we shouldn't be shamed by. Our culture shapes us and shows us how to be and how to live and that kind of stuff. But you can be perfectly conformed to the mores of your culture and not be at all righteous. So righteousness is an entirely different thing, and that's what I would argue is utterly individualistic. You can't be communally righteous, neither can the community block you from being righteous by not cooperating. A person whose heart is right with God and whose desire is to know God and serve him is perfectly free to do that in any and every culture and context, I think, as an individual. And notice the implications of that then. You see this in Paul, is morality ends up being relative to your ethics. In certain contexts, certain behavior will be hateful to your neighbor that wouldn't be hateful to your neighbor in another culture, because it all depends on what's the cultural significance of that particular action. Well, if you know the cultural significance of it and you know it would be hurtful and harmful, then it's unloving and you shouldn't do it. But in another culture, that same action may not be unloving at all. Yeah, whether you wear a hat when you pray, how you greet people, how you show or receive hospitality is significantly different. In some cultures, it would be completely rude to not just pump them full of food. In American culture, the tendency is, help yourself, dude. Make yourself at home. I'm not going to tell you what you can eat, can't eat, have to eat, don't have to eat. I just want you to feel perfectly at home and help yourself. But somebody coming from another culture would think you're being incredibly unloving and unkind and inhospitable to them because you're not offering them fruit every minute and every second. Well, it just depends on the culture then, how you're going to love them. You're going to love them. You're going to love your neighbors yourself in a way, in a medium, in a mode that makes sense to them if you know the culture well enough to be able to do that. Yes, right. And is that directed outside of me toward someone else, namely my neighbor? Absolutely. Yeah, if that's what you meant by obeyed socially, then absolutely. Because at the heart of the law is the way I relate to other people. And so to be quietly, passively righteous without ever loving any neighbor is completely wrongheaded. Jesus modeled being a human being whose very existence was for others and not for himself, was to serve and not be served. So if that's what you mean by a social aspect, absolutely there's a social aspect to righteousness. That's true. I understand your question better. In that sense, absolutely. What I thought you were asking is, are there any moral laws that I would be blocked from obeying because two of us need to join together in order to do that? And that's what I'm saying. No, I don't think so. I think I can be a person whose heart is committed to loving my neighbor, and I don't need you to join with me to love my neighbor. I can do that from out of the freedom of who I am. But you're absolutely right, because we as human beings are by our very nature social beings, language, tradition, modeling, products of our culture. Yes, my righteousness, just as my very being itself, is going to be to that extent social in nature. Yeah.
Earlier you were talking about that with respect to, he was saying that the Mosaic law has to be acted out socially as a society, but that's a different sense of society. So those are different things that are being talked about here. One is acting righteously in a social context, and the other is acting righteously as a society. Is that not right?
Right, I think so. But I would be utterly blocked from keeping the Mosaic covenant. Is the distinction clear? You would complain about being on a desert island by yourself. Loving your neighbor would not be able to be expressed, but could the commitment still be there?
Sure.
Is that it? Okay, thank you.